This is Resonance 104.4 FM. Flipping marvellous. How you doing? I'm Nick Hennigan. This is Literary London, where we talk about all things kind of literary and Londonery. Except not today, because we're going to talk about an American writer. Oh, yes, we are. Celebrating the life. It's kind of a birthday, actually. January the 19th. There was born in Boston, the United States of America, to David and Elsbeth Eliza Poe, a child, Edgar Allan Poe. And so I thought it'd be a good thing to celebrate some of his works, quotes, life. He was obviously American, of course, born in Boston, a literary critic, writer, poet, author, editor, you know, general kind of all-round good guy. And in fact, I bought a book quite recently, I don't know if you've read it yet, by Stephen Marsh, called On Writing and Failure. I'm not sure if I can, I don't know, I might try and see if I can get a hold to have a chat with him, because it's an interesting book which talks about, well, writing and failure. The quote on the back, good writers offer advice, great writers offer condolences. Anyway, I digress slightly. But Edgar Allan Poe, I say, an all-round kind of smart bloke, best known for his poetry and short stories. And he was quite revolutionary, I think, in his way. He was famous for his tales of the mystery and the macabre. And in fact, we're going to sample a bit of that in a moment or two. Widely regarded as a central figure of romanticism and gothic fiction in the United States, and of course of American literature generally. I'm quite into the gothic stuff, having produced a show called The Birth of Frankenstein. I don't know why I do that laugh. I don't know why it was. It's all about Mary Shelley. We produced it at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, the Edinburgh Festival last year. It may be going out again, but I... watch this space, as they say. But yes, Edgar Allan Poe, one of the earliest practitioners of the short story, is also considered one of the inventors of the detective fiction genre, and a significant contributor to the emerging genre of science fiction. Also, perhaps the first well-known American writer to earn a living through writing alone, which resulted in a financially difficult life and career. Well, there's a surprise, hey? A writer? What? Struggling? We're actually on, this is Resonance 104.4 FM. I've set up a little website called bohemianbritain.com. Go check it out. And these shows all appear on there as well. And I set it up because Literary London, which you're listening to now, got voted the number two most popular bohemian podcast to listen to in the world by, who is it by? Can't remember. Some organisation. Number one was in New York. And this was number two, and it made me smile a bit. And I thought, what's a bohemian podcast? Does it mean you have to be starving when you record it? Does it mean you can only record in a little garret? Mind you, having said that, where I'm recording, this isn't much better than a little garret. It's a broom cupboard, but it's a very friendly broom cupboard. So I set up bohemianbritain.com as a bit of a hoot. And it's full of all sorts of tales of people who tend to struggle a little bit with their writing, making a living out of it. So, as I say, Edgar Allan Poe, born in Boston, Massachusetts, on the 19th of January, 1809, the second child to an American actor, David Poe Jr., and the English-born actress, Elizabeth Arnold Hopkins Poe. So, got a UK-US thing. He had an older brother, Henry, and a younger sister, Rosalie. And their grandfather, David Poe, had emigrated from County Cavan in Ireland around 1750. So there's another connection. My name's Hennigan. My gang are from Mayo, County Mayo, in Ireland. Lovely part of the world. And I know I won't tell you more about my family. You don't want to hear about that. Let's hear a bit more about Edgar Allan Poe. I love some of his quotes as well. Let me just see if I can find some of the quotes that he came out with, Edgar Allan Poe. One of them, he said, apparently, I wish I could write as mysterious as a cat. Okay, all right, right. That's fine. I quite like this one. Those who dream by day are cognizant of many things which escape those who dream only by night. Oh, this one's quite sweet. The death of a beautiful woman is unquestionably the most poetical topic in the world. That sort of probably was true then, and I'm sure it sort of fairly is now. Another of his quotes, poetry is the rhythmical creation of beauty in words. He said, with me, poetry has not been a purpose, but a passion. All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. So he knew a few things. I quite like this one as well. How many good books suffer neglect through the insufficiency of their beginnings? But I thought what we might do is play an example of his glorious writing. And so, read by the inevitable Basil Rathbone, this is Edgar Allan Poe and The Fall of the House of Usher.
During the whole of a dull, dark and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I had been passing alone on horseback through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of the evening drew on, within view of the melancholy House of Usher. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. I looked upon the scene before me, upon the mere house and the simple landscape features of the domain, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant eye-like windows, upon a few rank sedges, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees, with an utter depression of soul. What was it, I paused to think, what was it that so unnerved me in the contemplation of the House of Usher? It was a mystery all insoluble. Nevertheless, in this mansion of gloom I now proposed to myself a sojourn of some weeks. Its proprietor, Roderick Usher, had been one of my boon companions in boyhood, but many years had elapsed since our last meeting. A letter, however, had lately reached me in a distant part of the country, a letter from him which, in its wildly importunate nature, had admitted of no other than a personal reply. The writer spoke of acute bodily illness, of a mental disorder which oppressed him, and of an earnest desire to see me as his best and indeed his only personal friend, with a view of attempting, by the cheerfulness of my society, some alleviation of his malady. Although as boys we had been even intimate associates, yet I really knew little of my friend. His reserve had been always excessive and habitual. I was aware, however, that his very ancient family had been noted time out of mind for a peculiar sensibility of temperament. I had learned, too, the very remarkable fact that the stem of the Usher race, all time honoured as it was, had put forth at no period any enduring branch. In other words, that the entire family lay in the direct line of descent and had always, with very trifling and very temporary variation, so lain. The House of Usher. I scanned more narrowly the real aspect of the building. Its principal feature seemed to be that of an excessive antiquity, yet all this was apart from any extraordinary dilapidation. Perhaps the eye of a scrutinizing observer might have discovered a barely perceptible fissure, which, extending from the roof of the building in front, made its way down the wall in a zigzag direction until it became lost in the sullen waters of the tarn. A servant in waiting took my horse, and I entered the Gothic archway of the hall. A valet of stealthy step thence conducted me in silence through many dark and intricate passages in my progress to the studio of the master. Feeble gleams of encrimsoned light made their way through the trellised panes and served to render sufficiently distinct the more prominent objects around. Dark draperies hung upon the walls. The general furniture was profuse, comfortless, antique, and tattered. Many books and musical instruments lay scattered about, but failed to give any vitality to the scene. An air of stern, deep, and irredeemable gloom hung over and pervaded all. Upon my entrance, Usher arose from a sofa on which he had been lying at full length. Surely a man had never before so terribly altered in so brief a period as had Roderick Usher. It was with difficulty that I could bring myself to admit the identity of the one being before me with the companion of my early boyhood. The now ghastly pallor of the skin and the now miraculous lustre of the eye, above all things, startled and even awed me. The silken hair, too, had been suffered to grow all unheeded, and as, in its wild gossamer texture, it floated rather than fell about the face, I could not even with effort connect its arabesque expression with any idea of simple humanity. In the manner of my friend, I was at once struck with an incoherence, an inconsistency. His action was alternately vivacious and sullen. It was thus that he spoke of the object of my visit, of his earnest desire to see me, and of the solace he expected me to afford him. He entered at some length into what he conceived to be the nature of his malady. It was, he said, a constitutional and a family evil, and one for which he despaired to find a remedy. A mere nervous affection, he immediately added, which would undoubtedly soon pass off. It displayed itself in a host of unnatural sensations. Some of these, as he detailed them, interested and bewildered me. He suffered much from a morbid acuteness of the senses. The most insipid food was alone endurable. He could wear only garments of certain texture. The odours of all flowers were oppressive. His eyes were tortured by even a faint light, and there were but peculiar sounds, and these from stringed instruments, which did not inspire him with horror. To an anomalous species of terror, I found him a bounden slave. "I shall perish," said he. "I must perish in this deplorable folly. I dread the events of the future, not in themselves, but in their results. I shudder at the thought of any, even the most trivial incident, which may operate upon this intolerable agitation of soul." I learned, moreover, at intervals, and through broken and equivocal hints, another singular feature of his mental condition. He was enchained by certain superstitious impressions in regard to the dwelling which he tenanted, and whence for many years he had never ventured forth. He admitted, however, although with hesitation, that much of the peculiar gloom which thus afflicted him could be traced to a more natural, a far more palpable origin, to the severe and long-continued illness, indeed to the evidently approaching dissolution, of a tenderly beloved sister, his sole companion for long years, his last and only relative on earth. "Her decease," he said, with a bitterness which I can never forget, "would leave him the hopeless and the frail, the last of the ancient race of the Ushers." While he spoke, the Lady Madeline, for so was she called, passed through a remote portion of the apartment, and without having noticed my presence, disappeared. I regarded her with an utter astonishment, not unmingled with dread, and yet I found it impossible to account for such feelings. When the door at length closed upon her, my glance sought instinctively and eagerly the countenance of the brother, but he had buried his face in his hands, and I could only perceive that a far more than ordinary wanness had overspread the emaciated fingers through which trickled many passionate tears. The disease of the Lady Madeline had long baffled the skill of her physicians. A settled apathy, a gradual wasting away of the person, and frequent, although transient, affections of a partially cataleptical character were the unusual diagnosis. Hitherto she had steadily borne up against the pressure of her malady, and had not betaken herself finally to bed, but on the closing in of the evening of my arrival at the house, she did so, as her brother told me at night with inexpressible agitation. And I learned that the glimpse I had obtained of her person would thus, probably, be the last I should obtain. For several days ensuing, her name was unmentioned by either Usher or myself, and during this period I was busied in earnest endeavours to alleviate the melancholy of my friend. We painted and read together, and I listened, as if in a dream, to the wild improvisations of his speaking guitar, and thus, as a closer and still closer intimacy admitted me more unreservedly into the recesses of his spirit, the more bitterly did I perceive the futility of all attempt at cheering a mind from which darkness, as if an inherent positive quality, poured forth upon all objects of the moral and physical universe in one unceasing radiation of gloom. One evening, having informed me abruptly that the Lady Madeline was no more, He stated his intention of preserving her corpse for a fortnight, previously to its final interment, in one of the numerous vaults within the main walls of the building. The worldly reason, however, assigned for this singular proceeding was one which I did not feel at liberty to dispute. The brother had been led to his resolution, so he told me, by considerations of the unusual character of the malady of the deceased, of certain obtrusive and eager inquiries on the part of her medical men, and of the remote and exposed situation of the burial ground of the family. At the request of Usher, I personally aided him in the arrangements for the temporary entombment. The body having been encoffined, we two alone bore it to its rest. The vault in which we placed it, and which had been so long unopened that our torches, half smothered in its oppressive atmosphere, were small and damp, lying at great depth immediately beneath that portion of the building in which was my own sleeping apartment. The door was of massive iron, its immense weight caused an unusually sharp grating sound as it moved upon its hinges. Having deposited our mournful burden upon trestles within this region of horror, we partially turned aside the yet unscrewed lid of the coffin and looked upon the face of the tenant. A striking similitude between the brother and sister now first arrested my attention, and Usher, divining perhaps my thoughts, murmured out some few words from which I learned that the deceased and himself had been twins, and that sympathies of a scarcely intelligible nature had always existed between them. Our glances, however, rested not long upon the dead, for we could not regard her unawed. The disease which had thus entombed the lady in the maturity of youth had left, as usual in all maladies of a strictly cataleptical character, the mockery of a faint blush upon the bosom and the face, and that suspiciously lingering smile upon the lip which is so terrible in death. We replaced and screwed down the lid, and having secured the door of iron, made our way with toil into the scarcely less gloomy apartments of the upper portion of the house. And now, some days of bitter grief having elapsed, an observable change came over the features of the mental disorder of my friend. He roamed from chamber to chamber with hurried, unequal, and objectless step. The pallor of his countenance had assumed, if possible, a more ghastly hue, but the luminousness of his eye had utterly gone out. A tremulous quaver, as if of extreme terror, habitually characterized his utterance. At times again, I beheld him gazing upon vacancy for long hours, in an attitude of the profoundest attention, as if listening to some imaginary sound. It was no wonder that his condition terrified, that it infected me. I felt creeping upon me by slow yet certain degrees the wild influences of his own fantastic yet impressive superstitions. It was especially upon retiring to bed late in the night of the seventh or eighth day after the placing of the Lady Madeline within the dungeon that I experienced the full power of such feelings. Sleep came not near my couch. While the hours waned and waned away, I struggled to reason off the nervousness which had dominion over me. I endeavoured to believe that much, if not all, of what I felt was due to the bewildering influence of the dark and tattered draperies which, tortured into motion by the breath of a rising tempest, swayed fitfully to and fro upon the walls. But my efforts were fruitless. An irrepressible tremor gradually pervaded my frame, and at length there sat upon my very heart an incubus of utterly causeless alarm. I uplifted myself upon the pillows, and peering earnestly within the intense darkness of the chamber, hearkened, I know not why, except that an instinctive spirit prompted me, to certain low and indefinite sounds which came through the pauses of the storm at long intervals I knew not whence. Overpowered by an intense sentiment of horror, unaccountable yet unendurable, I threw on my clothes with haste, for I felt that I should sleep no more during the night, and endeavoured to arouse myself from the pitiable condition into which I had fallen by pacing rapidly to and fro through the apartment. I had taken but few turns in this manner when a light step on an adjoining staircase arrested my attention. I presently recognized it as that of Usher. In an instant afterward, he rapped with a gentle touch at my door and entered, bearing a lamp. There was a species of mad hilarity in his eyes, an evidently restrained hysteria in his whole demeanour. His air appalled me. But anything was preferable to the solitude which I had so long endured, and I even welcomed his presence as a relief. "And you've not seen it?" he said abruptly. "You have not then seen it? But stay, you shall." Thus speaking, and having carefully shaded his lamp, he hurried to one of the casements and threw it freely open to the storm. The impetuous fury of the entering gust nearly lifted us from our feet. A whirlwind had apparently collected its force in our vicinity, for there were frequent and violent alterations in the direction of the wind, and the exceeding density of the clouds, which hung so low as to press upon the turrets of the house, did not prevent our perceiving the lifelike velocity with which they flew careering from all points against each other without passing away into the distance. The undersurfaces of the huge masses of agitated vapour were glowing in the unnatural light of a faintly luminous and distinctly visible gaseous exhalation which hung about and enshrouded the mansion. "You must not, you shall not behold this," said I, shuddering to Usher, as I led him with a gentle violence from the window to a seat. "These appearances, which bewilder you, are merely electrical phenomena, not uncommon, or it may be that they have their ghastly origin in the rank miasma of the town. Let us close the casement. Here is one of your favourite romances. I will read, and you shall listen, and so we will pass away this terrible night together." The antique volume which I had taken up was The Mad Tryst of Sir Lancelot Canning, but I had called it a favourite of Usher's more in sad jest than in earnest. It was, however, the only book immediately at hand. I had arrived at that well-known portion of the story where Ethelred, the hero of the tryst, having sought in vain for peaceable admission into the dwelling of the hermit, proceeds to make good an entrance by force, uplifted his mace outright, and so cracked and ripped and tore all asunder that the noise of the dry and hollow-sounding wood alarmed and reverberated through the forest. At the termination of this sentence, I started, and for a moment paused, for it appeared to me that from some very remote portion of the mansion there came indistinctly to my ears what might have been, in its exact similarity of character, the echo, but a stifled and dull one, certainly, of the very cracking and ripping sound which Sir Lancelot had so particularly described. It was beyond doubt the coincidence alone which had arrested my attention, for amid the rattling of the sashes of the casements and the ordinary commingled noises of the still increasing storm, the sound in itself had nothing, surely, which should have interested or disturbed me. I continued the story. But the good champion Ethelred, now entering within the door, was sore enraged and amazed to perceive no signal of the maliceful hermit, but in the stead thereof, a dragon of a scaly and prodigious demeanour and of a fiery tongue, and Ethelred uplifted his mace and struck upon the head of the dragon, which fell before him and gave up his pesty breath with a shriek so horrid and harsh, and withal so piercing that Ethelred had fain to close his ears with his hands against the dreadful noise of it, the like whereof... Here again I paused abruptly, and now with a feeling of wild amazement, for there could be no doubt whatever that in this instance I did actually hear a low and apparently distant but harsh, protracted and most unusual screaming or grating sound. I still retained sufficient presence of mind to avoid exciting by any observation the sensitive nervousness of my companion. I was by no means certain that he had noticed the sounds in question, although assuredly a strange alteration had, during the last few minutes, taken place in his demeanour. From a position fronting my own, he had gradually brought his chair so as to sit with his face to the door of the chamber, and thus I could but partially perceive his features, although I saw that his lips trembled as if he were murmuring inaudibly. His head had dropped upon his breast, yet I knew that he was not asleep, from the wide and rigid opening of the eye as I caught a glimpse of it in profile. The motion of his body, too, was at variance with this idea, for he rocked from side to side with a gentle yet constant and uniform sway. Having rapidly taken notice of all this, I resumed the narrative of Sir Lancelot, which thus proceeded. And now the champion, having escaped from the terrible fury of the dragon, bethought himself of the brazen shield, which in sooth tarried not for his full coming, but fell down at his feet upon the silver floor with a mighty, great, and terrible ringing sound. No sooner had these syllables passed my lips than, as if a shield of brass had indeed at the moment fallen heavily upon a floor of silver, I became aware of a distinct, hollow, metallic, and clangorous, yet apparently muffled reverberation. Completely unnerved, I leapt to my feet, but the measured rocking movement of Usher was undisturbed. I rushed to the chair in which he sat. His eyes were bent fixedly before him, and throughout his whole countenance there reigned a stony rigidity. But as I placed my hand upon his shoulder, there came a strong shudder over his whole person. A sickly smile quivered about his lips, and I saw that he spoke in a low, hurried, and gibbering murmur, as if unconscious of my presence. Bending closely over him, I at length drank in the hideous import of his words. Now hear it. Yes, I hear it, and have heard it. Long, 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 many minutes, many hours, many days have I heard it, yet I dared not. Oh, pity me, miserable wretch that I am, I dared not speak. We have put her living in the tomb. Said I not that my senses were acute? I now tell you that I heard her first feeble movements in the hollow coffin. I heard them many, many days ago, yet I dared not speak. And now, tonight, Ethelred, the breaking of the hermit's door, and the death cry of the dragon, and the clangor of the shield, say rather the rending of her coffin, and the grating of the iron hinges of her prison, and her struggles within the coppered archway of the vault. Oh, whither shall I fly? Will she not be here anon? Is she not hurrying to upbraid me for my haste? Have I not heard her footstep on the stair? Do I not distinguish that heavy and horrible beating of her heart? Madman! I tell you that she now stands without the door. As if in the superhuman energy of his utterance there had been found the potency of a spell, the huge antique panels to which the speaker pointed threw slowly back upon the instant their ponderous and ebony jaws. It was the work of a rushing gust. But then, without those doors, there did stand the lofty and enshrouded figure of the Lady Madeline of Usher. There was blood upon her white robes, and the evidence of some bitter struggle upon every portion of her emaciated frame. For a moment she remained trembling and reeling to and fro upon the threshold, then with a low moaning cry fell heavily inward upon the person of her brother, and in her violent and now final death agonies bore him to the floor, a corpse and a victim to the terrors he had anticipated. From that chamber and from that mansion I fled aghast. The storm was still abroad in all its wrath as I found myself crossing the old causeway. Suddenly there shot along the path a wild light, and I turned to see whence a gleam so unusual could have issued, for the vast house and its shadows were alone behind me. The radiance was that of the full setting and blood-red moon, which now shone vividly through that once barely discernible fissure of which I have spoken before as extending from the roof of the building in a zigzag direction to the base. While I gazed, this fissure rapidly widened. There came a fierce breath of the whirlwind. The entire orb of the satellite burst at once upon my sight. My brain reeled as I saw the mighty walls rushing asunder. There was a long, tumultuous shouting sound, like the voice of a thousand waters, and the deep and dank tarn at my feet closed sullenly and silently over the fragments of the House of Usher.
Oh, The Fall of the House of Usher, written by Edgar Allan Poe, born on the 19th of January, 1809, in Boston, Massachusetts. And, well, that was kind of cool, wasn't it? Yeah. So that's it. That's all we've got time for. He passed away, by the way, 7th of October, 1849, just so that you get the whole story. But thank you very much for your company. I'm on bohemianbritain.com, if you want to have a look at that. Oh, yes. And again, if you want to get in touch, nick@bohemianbritain.com or radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk. nick@bohemianbritain.com or radio@mavericktheatre.co.uk gets you to me. Thank you very much for your time. This is Literary London. I'm Nick Hennigan, and this is Resonance 104.4 FM.